Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, September 2nd, 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Milton Alamotti, co-founder of Black Star News, PhD student at Howard University, discussing the $12.8 billion funding gap facing historically black colleges and universities. Also on the program, U.S. bombs a wedding party in Iran. Untold number of deaths, civilian deaths, of course. This as Iran hits U.S. bases in their biggest exchange since July. Massachusetts' Ed Markey trounces Seth Douchey Moulton.
Poser.
This, meanwhile, the Massachusetts congressional incumbents hold on to their seats. Capitol Hill, Hakeem Jeffries, criticized by Nancy Pelosi for losing control of his caucus as two Democrats defect to help Mike Johnson pass a rules vote.
She could at least whip her caucus. He's also incompetent, too.
Pete Hegseth continues his purge of the military by targeting woke officers. Black and female officers. Cubans living in Florida being deported to Africa. ICE arrests top 50,000 in August, again at a record-breaking pace. California, meanwhile, passes a bill, or I should say the lawmakers do. We'll see if it gets signed by Gavin Newsom, that would prevent former ICE agents from holding a wide range of public sector jobs in California. And in the wake of deportation orders for up to 350,000 Haitians, the U.S. extends its ban on commercial flights to Haiti because of gang violence. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is
Hump Day.
Oh, yeah, it is, says Emma Vigeland. I lost track of what day it was.
Me too, almost, but I couldn't forget.
Just getting back into the swing of things, the school year starting. My son's still not in school yet.
Oh, they don't start?
New York, they don't start until after Labor Day, and Labor Day's late, and so. Be that as it may, we got a lot to talk about today. We will get more into that, Hakeem Jeffries. I mean, it's, maybe worth just mentioning up top. There are, and according to Nancy Pelosi, this is somewhat unprecedented, where members of your caucus defect not to vote for legislation that maybe most Democrats won't vote for. That is, that happens. You'll find a couple. But two Democrats, Jared Golden and Marie Hugelskamp.
Glusenkamp Perez.
Exactly. voted for a rules change, which with the Republicans, so that they could bring up a whole host of legislation one of which was the condemnation of socialism.
So they allowed these two Democrats to have hours of debate attacking the left on the House floor via this, you know, bill about socialism.
The ostensibly golden and I can't remember. I can't say
MGP.
MGP said that they were interested in a bill that was protecting supposedly protecting lobstermen on both coasts from protections of whales, and to push back this protection of whales on behalf of lobstermen. I can only imagine what Jared Golden received, you know.
In exchange for that?
Yes.
We will talk about this more. It's an important story because it shows that Jeffries is not only ideologically out of step with the base, but he's incompetent at doing the basic nuts and bolts of his job, which is keeping the caucus together.
Yeah. When asked about it, he said, "You should ask Catherine, who is the whip."
Blaming his number two. This is what quarterbacks sound like when they are about to get benched. Blaming the offensive line or the protection or the receiver or the rest of the team. Like, it's quite literally not your job to do that as a leader. It's poor leadership just from that standpoint. If you just care about the Democrats as a united front.
Maybe there's other things he cares about.
There might be something else. So I don't think this is the rotating villain strategy as they use for things like Pentagon funding, because this is so professionally embarrassing for Jeffries that, as Sam said, it wasn't just Pelosi saying this. All Capitol Hill reporters were talking about how unprecedented this is, that a minority leader loses control of his caucus on a rules procedural motion like this. Jeffries is bad at his job in every facet.
Moving on, let's start with this. Last night there was exchange of missile fire and drone fire between the U.S. and Iran. U.S. Reportedly hit a wedding party in Iran, and of course the U.S. is not taking credit for that, claims that they hit some type of military base. We've been through this before, and Iran hit a U.S. Base in Kuwait, and frankly, again, it could be more extensive than that, because the United States has not been in any way forthcoming with the effectiveness of Iranian strikes. This was interesting. Manu Raju from CNN asked Mike Johnson the obvious question one would ask of the Speaker of the House, just for those people who have never had any civics lessons in elementary school, or for those who never saw those weekend cartoons about how, you know, the U.S. government works. Or apparently also for the Speaker of the House. It is the House that controls the purse strings of a war. If they wanted to end the war in Iran, they could do so tomorrow. I mean, I guess today. If they wanted to pass a War Powers Act, they could do so today. I just say that because apparently Mike Johnson unaware of this.
I think there was a moment today that was so telling on Capitol Hill when Manu was asking House Speaker Mike Johnson about the timeline for this war and what the American people should expect.
On Iran, you said repeatedly that this war was going to be over soon. You said that this would be a temporary blip on short term, on gas prices. It is more than 6 months. People are getting hurt still at the pump. Should the American people not also judge you on your projections here that were clearly off base?
Manu, that is one of the stupidest questions you've ever asked.
Why is that so big?
I have nothing to do with the prosecution of the war across the globe. I am
responsible. You are selling this to the American public, are you not?
So should the House Speaker be held responsible for the duration of a military conflict around the globe? Yes. You answer that question.
That's an easy one to answer. The answer is, of course.
In fact, your body has abdicated its responsibility as the body, the legislature, that is supposed to be responsible for the declaration of war.
Yeah, one word, constitution.
Yeah. It's quite literally in the text.
Who are we supposed to be going to? The comptroller of Dutchess County?
No, that's a question for Jared Kushner.
Yeah, exactly. But obviously Mike Johnson sweating it. There's got to be a lot of pressure on the Hill, because you have now reports of Republican lawmakers in like +9Republican districts who are sweating whether they're going to win their midterm elections. Now, of course, we are every day we see more and more indication of how the Trump administration plans to at least inhibit the votes of people who are going to be voting against them. Hopefully in the next couple of days, we'll have somebody on to talk about this U.S. postal worker whistleblower who has found that there is a portal that is set up in conjunction with the requirement that some states fulfilled, red states, to get voter lists, and the portal apparently is like just set up to disenfranchise tens of thousands of people based on being triggered by stuff like if somebody's using their maiden name instead of their married name. Like one individual will trigger 10,000 people getting essentially a lack of ability to vote via mail. We'll talk more about that as it goes. We also have some the vote in Texas that the election committee essentially voted to close 30% of the voting, the polling places in one of Texas's biggest counties where about 2 million people vote. And we have some footage from that. We'll talk about that in a bit. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, this guy won.
We need to tax the rich, block the bombs, and stop data centers from polluting our community. We must fight for the laws that put people ahead of profit. Why should we be hopeful in this moment when there is so much fear and hate? Why am I so optimistic? Because there are more of us than there are of them. Because when we stand together with better ideas and stronger ideals, they do not stand a chance. Because the many will always beat the money. And we know that our work is more than a campaign, more than even just this moment in which we are all being called to act. Our progressive movement knows how to fight. We cannot surrender. Tomorrow, and for the next 8 weeks, in every corner of the Commonwealth and across the country, we have to hit the streets.
He defeated Seth Moulton by 65-35%. I mean, this was a trouncing.
Yeah. And also in initial, exit polling or initial data that's come out, it's shown that the only place where Moulton managed to defeat Markey with a majority would be in the wealthiest towns, really, in the state. That was where he was able to have success, but Markey ran up the numbers everywhere.
We should also say, you know, Seth Moulton was one of the first people to come out and claim that the Democrats lost in 2024 based upon trans people sports involvement.
He said some offensive things about trans girls and women participating in sports.
You're
and
not allowed to say this stuff anymore. He literally played that guy.
And you know what Ed Markey did, who has a history of fighting for regular people? He proposed a trans bill of rights. So I'm looking forward to the half a dozen think pieces. Actually, that's probably conservative. The dozens of think pieces that are going to be coming out in the mainstream press about how transphobia is an electoral issue for Democrats in primaries now, right? That must be what this data is showing. That
coastal deep blue states.
Oh, yeah.
Disregard that.
Can't extrapolate it.
Well, we should also, you know, note that Massachusetts not quite as blue as people suggest, particularly on issues like this. But nevertheless, Moulton came out and we now know, based on data, that none of that is true. We know that it was a function of inflation. We know that it was a function of Gaza. We know that it was a function of a shortened campaign in 2024. But for him to jump on that gave an indication of where some of these conservative Democrats were hoping to go. And
right.
He failed.
Yeah. And it look at what his instinct was there and then how he had to do a complete 180 when he was running in this primary. He thought that it would be not enough to go after the age tag with Markey, this aesthetic thing that, oh, wow, it must have just been Biden's age that people had a problem with.
Generational change.
Look, well, it was a major problem, I think, for the Democrats that Biden had was unable to communicate even some of the good things that he did domestically because he had issues articulating himself, and that was a major problem. But if D.C. really thinks this is just about age, they have a rude awakening coming to them, and I think it's already happening. Like, they're desperate to avoid the ideological battle in the party, and this is another example of how this isn't about age. This is about the substance of what they stand for. And Moulton was unable to lie to the people of Massachusetts as he wanted in the way that he wanted, because he was apparently directing these super PAC spending on his behalf to frame him as a progressive when he has, you know, a very pro-Israel record, taking money from private equity, Wall Street, pro-AI, etc.
Generational change apparently does not mean let's go back to 1993.
Right.
Or even more accurately, 1995. Seth Moulton is now, I think, floating at the bottom of the Charles River. probably. They found Whitey Bulger, though, didn't they? They did find Whitey.
They found him in Santa Monica, California.
Yeah. Well, we won't have Seth Moulton to kick around anymore. I'm pretty happy about that, actually.
Yep.
What else we got here? Let's go. Do we have time for this? No. We'll take a quick. I've got in a moment. We're going to be talking to Milton Alamati, co-founder of the Black Star News, PhD student at Howard University, to discuss the huge funding gap facing historically black colleges and universities. First, a word from our sponsor. It's actually been, for whatever reason, from a schedule standpoint, I haven't hung out with my cat for a while. The cat goes back and forth with my child, and but my cat, I see really no difference when the cat is there or not there, or I should say, I smell no difference because of Smalls. I'm not doing like in-depth research on this in terms of like sticking my head, you know, deep into the kitty litter box. But
that would be bad.
That would be bad.
You're not doing that.
But the fact of the matter is that after getting my cat on Smalls, their poop has been less smelly. I mean, and I presume healthier. And that's because Smalls is a healthier fresh human grade cat food that is made from high quality meat, not cheap fillers. Meat apparently is easier for cats to digest. Their bodies absorb more nutrients, and what comes out the other side? A healthier poop. The stuff that I used to feed my cat with, I thought it was a cat problem. I mean, look, you know, they still pooping inside, but nevertheless. And Smalls isn't just good for digestion. 88% of cat parents say that after feeding Smalls, their cats are is softer, shinier, has more energy, and overall just seems healthier because it's really good for cats. I should also say my cat goes ballistic for their broth. It is a great way to give them both like a treat and hydration. He just loves it. If you want to invest in your cat's health, Smalls is giving you 60% off your cat's first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you go to smalls.com/majority. If your cat doesn't like it, Smalls will refund 100% of your order. But trust me, your cat's going to love the taste of Smalls, and you'll love that your house no longer smells like a giant litter box. I have very poor circulation in my apartment. That's part of the problem. So when my cat's poop don't smell, that's a major upgrade for me. 60% off plus free shipping and free treats for life when you go to smalls.com/majority. I'm going to take a quick break, and then we'll be talking to Milton Alamati, co-founder of Black Star News. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Milton Alamati, co-founder of Black Star News. Milton, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me. My pleasure. Good to see both of you.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you as well. Let's just, for the sake of folks who don't understand the sort of like broad history of historically black colleges and universities, let's will you just walk through the genesis largely of HBCUs in this country, and then we'll talk about land grants, and which is at the very least one source of their lack of funding as of late.
Right. Okay, so good. I mean, obviously people that are conscious and know history know that education was not one of the foundations during the period of enslavement, right? So after the Civil War, the idea was that to set up institutions that would allow higher education for formerly enslaved. And Howard was one of those first institutions that was created in 1867. And of course, initially, I think the expectations were not that ambitious. So maybe we can train people to become, you know, like church ministers, and then eventually get some to become doctors. And then, of course, as people started exerting their humanity, now they're released and freed from this historical bondage. I mean, of course, their aspirations started flourishing. And lo and behold, we now have full-fledged institutions like Howard University with professional programs, with multiple programs, with undergraduate students, as well as graduate students. And of course, people that don't know the history of HBCUs should really go back and look a little bit at the history that we are talking about right now. It's not that, because sometimes in this modern environment, people that are not curious about history get the sense that, oh, maybe African Americans just don't like mingling with the broader population and want to have their own niche institutions. These institutions evolve from a certain very critical history. Without these institutions, formerly enslaved people would never have had access to education. So I think that's very important for people to realize that because it's not widely taught. So I would not be surprised if there are many people that believe that these institutions exist just because African-Americans want to seclude themselves in this learning process. So I think that was important to get out as well.
My understanding is that most HBCUs, kind of the explosion of the creation of HBCUs, happened during the period of Reconstruction. And obviously, we've talked about Reconstruction on the show quite a bit. What is the relationship of HBCUs to Reconstruction? And then, of course, how it fell apart as well.
Well, of course, it was a very critical component of it. And thankfully, it was one of the few institutions that was not abandoned, right? During the restructured people that during the
Milton, we're having a little bit of connection
these
problem.
Institutions because they would have been abandoned.
Milton, we're having a little bit of connection problems. Let's.
I think it might be caught up now, Milton, if you want to try that answer one more time.
Yeah, if you want to try one more time with that.
Oh. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep, I think we're good now.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, so I was saying, imagine if these institutions had been abandoned as part of this, the repudiation, the rejection, the regression of the Reconstruction, of the vision and the objectives of Reconstruction, when, of course, ultimately the South resurged, and there was a resurgence of what I would call neo-enslavement, and all the visions of having formerly enslaved gain higher office, be elected into the state legislator, into the natural legislator. All of that was, of course, abandoned in this reactionary period that led to the complete repudiation of what the whole idea of Reconstruction was all about. But fortunately, at least these historically Black colleges and universities survived, and that is why they still exist today. And of course, now, ironically, they are in an environment where they are threatened, like all other higher institutions of learning, but they're also threatened in a much more special way, because many of the students that attend these institutions come from working class families. They don't have the kind of endowment that a Harvard or a Columbia has. Harvard's is $1 billion, and it's considered to be actually prime compared to other HBCUs that average $250 million, $300 million. But of course, Harvard, $50 billion, Yale, $40 billion, Columbia, almost $20 billion. So now we see that these institutions don't have the kind of cushion that the Harvards and Yales of the world have.
And we should say, my understanding is it was the Morrill Act that established land-grant colleges, where the federal government would provide federal land to the states, and that would provide a funding stream for these colleges. And in the first version of the act, it ended up being mostly white colleges. It, following the Civil War in late, I mean, maybe technically outside of Reconstruction, in the late 1880s, I think it was, there was a second act that basically said you either have to integrate your colleges or set up separate colleges for formerly or for freedmen. And no surprise, a lot of these institutions basically said, in states said, we'll take the former, the latter, and set up. And so these land grants have been something that have been going forward at I think initially it was just the federal government giving actual land. And then subsequent to that, the USDA provides actual funding or is supposed to have. Right. But there has been a failure of that money going from the USDA to the states and then ending up essentially under funding HBCUs as opposed to the other institutions in these states.
Correct. And that's only one aspect of it, of course. And we know that even in the Trump era, where we have heard all these pronouncements of that HBCUs are not going to be affected, the funding is going to be continuing and it's going to be increasing. Those are the really the verbal commitments, you know. We have not seen a lot of these monies actually reaching these institutions. And ironically, the people that follow the news would know that many of the major donations have become are coming from private donors. Have been coming from private donors, Mackenzie Scott, for example, giving millions of dollars to these institutions. So yes, you're right. I mean, obviously, that was, I guess, another way of abandoning the vision of Reconstruction, even if it did occur after the period that Reconstruction really covered. And I mean, I think there's another component though. I mean, at this critical time, there are African-Americans of resources as well that have resources. And not only, you know, traditionally people point to people in the entertainment or athletes. It's not limited to that. There are some African-American entrepreneurs, people on Wall Street. And I think they should also take these institutions seriously and look back into the history and look back as into why they were founded in the first place. And you know, step forward. I mean, if people like the Mackenzie Scotts can commit millions of dollars, I don't see why more African-Americans of means cannot do the same.
We should say, too, that African-Americans make up HBCUs make up 3% of the country's colleges and universities, but produce 15% of all yes. African-American graduates. During Biden's administration, they were pushing for states to they were talking about this massive disparity in terms of essentially underfunding, where these land grants have been given by the USDA and administered by the state, and the money just simply hasn't been going to all of the land grant schools. It has only been going to the non-HBCU schools in these states. So this has left them underfunded. What's happened now under the Trump administration?
Actually, to be honest, I've not heard any movement on that particular issue. I mean, I did hear there was some coverage when the it was announced that even though there's going to be cuts in educational institutions generally, HBCUs were not going to be affected. But in terms of those being verbal commitments and the funding actually materializes, that to me seems to be the missing component.
Well, okay. So there, as far as I know, we have two different issues. One is the land grant thing that has been traditionally, and it's been a problem that existed prior to the Trump administration. And yes, in I think it was like the second month of the administration, Trump made some big executive order that we were going to fund HBCUs. And then classic Trump stuff. Nothing's happened since then, surprisingly. As far as I can tell, there's been a couple of ways in which the funding has dried up. They're under the Great Big Beautiful Bill or whatever it was called, the Federal Parent Plus funds, which essentially would provide loans for the full amount of a school. Those have been cut dramatically, and that has
They've been capped as well.
Yes, and just walk us through how that has impacted these institutions.
Okay, well, you know, previously there was essentially no limit, but now that there is a cap, if there's a cap, it means you have to look through additional funding to other sources. If there's a cap now, if there's now a ceiling on funds that previously, so long as you were willing to take the commitment and take that loan, there was no cap. So you could fully fund your education using that process. But now that there's a cap on that, and that indeed came during the Trump administration, it means that you're going to have to look for other sources. Of course, other sources meaning you're going to be having to pay higher rates for those loans.
And that has ended up excluding, my understanding, is a significant portion of students because they simply don't have the means in which to find funding from other places. Let's also talk about the change in the funding for HBCUs that the Trump administration has done. My understanding is they've, instead of providing annual funding, they have given a essentially like a one-time chunk of money to funding, which makes it much harder for the universities to both absorb and to almost like amateurize over time.
And to plan as well. And I think that is probably what contributed to some of the challenges that we saw specifically at Howard. I mean, of course, I'm not, you know, familiar with the intricate details of the administration at the university and how they handle that. But I would imagine that that was probably one of the compelling reasons why they wanted students to provide their information much earlier and the complete information, not in stages, to enable them to plan and to compare the needs of the students with the resources that the university had available. And it led to what was widely covered in media when 500 students, incoming students, undergrads, were unenrolled. And of course, the publicity was not good for the university. And at the same time, I imagine the university administrators were handling all these challenges and pressures. I don't imagine this is the kind of thing that any educational institution would do without very serious pondering and consideration, because that's not the type of media that any education institution wants. 200 were reportedly subsequently re-enrolled in the university. And then the good thing was that the response from other institutions, other states, was also very good. I understand many of these students got absorbed either in the University of Maryland. And here in New York, of course, the governor also, Governor Hochul, said, I think New York would be able to absorb, if I recall, 200 additional of those students that had been unenrolled.
Is there anything else we should know at this point? I mean, Higher education's under a lot of pressure. I think we're going to see a lot of universities, both HBCUs and I should say colleges, and private colleges, close in the next couple of years because of just the operating costs and the difficulty and the lack of loans, and just it's a mess at this point.
No, it's a challenge. I mean, personally, my department, I'm doing actually a PhD at the history department at Howard, and I had funded my last 2 years with a graduate assistantship. Unfortunately, that was not renewed this semester, so I'm in the middle of scrambling around. Hopefully, even if I'm not able to fund for this semester, hopefully by this spring I'll be able to either pair myself with another fellowship or scholarship, or I've actually even launched a crowdfunding campaign. I want to make sure I'm back at least by the spring semester, you know.
Well,
so it is tough.
Yeah, good luck with that. And also, I should say, congratulations. My understanding is your book is coming out in 2 weeks on the Nigerian Civil War.
Yes.
The day Biafra died. Just tell us briefly.
What I found interesting was that a New York Times reporter, Lloyd Garrison, developed a very special relationship with a Swedish aviator and a former fighter pilot named Carl Gustav von Rosen, who actually told him about his plan to create a Biafran Air Force that would attack federal targets in May 1969. And Garrison, the New York Times, knew about this 1 month in advance before the Nigerian military government knew about it, and the attack did materialize. So that's one thing I found out, memos in the New York Times archives. And then the second thing was that Richard Nixon actually seemed on the verge of recognizing Biafra. He tilted totally, and I think a lot of it was because of the public pressure, the images of the famine victims in Biafra due to the Nigerian blockade. The images beamed on US TV, so there's a lot of domestic political pressure. So he totally pivoted, and he actually told Kissinger, I want the French to give the Biafrans more military weapons, and I'm going to personally, as he put it, run herd on Prime Minister Wilson of Britain so that Britain would also stop providing the Nigerians with weapons. But then I think Ojukwu made what turned out to be a fatal error. Nixon wanted the Red Cross to resume delivery of food to Biafra, which meant Biafra had to open its airport to daytime deliveries. And Ojukwu was not willing to do that. And when he refused to do that, Nixon sort of backed off on that path that seemed to would have led to the U.S. recognizing Biafra, which, of course, would have made it politically difficult for Nigeria to then still pursue a military solution.
We should tell people, too. I didn't give enough background on that. But Biafra was basically a secessionist state.
Correct.
In Nigeria,
right.
In the late 60s.
Correct. Declared independence in 67. And the website is thedaybiafradied.com for anybody interested.
We will put a link to that in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. Milton Alamadi, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. And good luck with the funding for the rest of your PhD.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for the work you guys do. There are forces out there that need to be challenged.
Thanks so
Indeed.
Much.
Thank
appreciate the talk.
Thank you.
All right, folks. That's it for us today. We're going to take some phone calls in the fun half today.
Yeah.
And you can join us in the fun half. You can IM the program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. It's also a way to keep this show thriving and surviving, or surviving and thriving, in that order, I guess. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lecky?
Can we talk about Hassan?
Hey, can we talk about Hassan?
The alpha males are back.
And they are.
David Griscom and I
did. Marky condemn Hassan? Is that how he won?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah, he spent the last couple of weeks condemning Hassan Piker and saying, how dare he say that thing that he has apologized for.
This Hassan Piker.
Can we just say, like, Hassan streams, Piker. Like, 14 hours a day, and that they have to point to something that was, I mean, in the almost previous decade, and they can't really point to anything else as, I think, shows how
it's
impeccably well-behaved he is.
It's total bullshit.
I don't know. Griscom and I did a Left Reckoning for folks. Check that out. We talked about Houston. Folks should check this out. Sam Resick has a piece in, I believe, the Texas Observer about the Houston mayor, Whitmire. I forget what his first name is. Not Whitmer, but Whitmire. And which I, anyway, check that out. A great discussion of another example of why moderates are bad at governing and shouldn't be trusted by voters to mm-hmm. govern. Who knows who wins in elections? Maybe it's a complete toss-up between progressives, although Marky Beaton Moulton would suggest maybe otherwise. But moderates can't govern. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
Three months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Yo.
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8? Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go for a walk.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid, though. Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge me.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
For people that were wondering what we were talking about in the break, we were talking about, who was it, Katie Porter or Amy Klobuchar, who ate her salad with a comb, and it was Klobuchar. And I believe the context of that was she was upset at the staffer for not bringing her a fork, and then made a big, like, show of eating it with a comb to discipline the staffer.
But did the comb condemn Hassan Piker? That's the real question.
That is what we're wondering.
Folks, that is grandma.
It is the fun half, ladies and gentlemen, of the program. Here is Hakeem Jeffries with...
What are you laughing at?
Just the signs are so lame. Hakeem Jeffries, I guess, making his big bid for what the Democrats are going to do if they control the House in the 2026 midterms.
You're right that those signs are dumb. The, like, white and exciting sign is Democrats.
We're alive.
And then dark red blood, Trump's reckless and costly war. But it would be more effective, dude, if you said anything on the Democrats' sign for what you're advocating for. How are you doing?
Affordability. Here he is coming out with their...
If they win the midterms, this is what Jeffries says the Democrats' agenda will be under his leadership.
And I will just preface this by saying, like, look, there is, I think there's a very good reason to believe the Democrats are going to take the House quite handily. And in many respects, this is sort of just a four corners, play, as it were.
Oh, did I just say Senate? I meant say take the House back. Yeah. Sorry if I misspoke.
And so he's probably trying to avoid saying anything that can be used against him. But this is the problem, ultimately is that I have no faith that they're going to do anything other than four corners once they get into power. But here is Hakeem Jeffries.
If Democrats do win the election and you are Speaker of the House next year, what more can you tell us about the agenda the Democrats will have, specifically beyond accountability, beyond affordability, any specific legislation or any particular investigations that you will prioritize?
Well, we're focused on winning the election and making the case to the American people in 63 days, I believe, that in order to move this country in a different direction, in order to actually... focus on the
now, pause it for 1 second. I just got to say, also in defense of Hakeem Jeffries, how could he have expected that a reporter at an event touting what the Democrats are going to do if they take Congress would ask a question like, what do you plan to do specifically if you take Congress?
Yep.
So defensive, like putting the word like actually in there. It's just like, why are you... anyway.
The amazing thing is that... I'm not going to talk about what we're going to do because we're focused on winning the election. But it seems that talking about what you're going to do might be an asset in your goal of trying to win the election. But that apparently is not the way this is working.
This is a guy who's after a title of speaker.
Yeah, go big. Well, that's another issue. Like, I got completely knocked off on what's your agenda question. I didn't think that one would come up. Literally, they have a sign that has, like, ostensibly what their investigation...
Affordable America. Yeah. How are you going to achieve said affordability? They can't answer it.
Play it from the beginning, because it really is sort of stunning how he seems to be completely knocked off balance.
Bewildered.
By this crazy question. Like, do you have any specifics?
If Democrats do win the election and you are Speaker of the House next year, what more can you tell us about the agenda the Democrats will have, specifically beyond accountability, beyond affordability, any specific legislation or any particular investigations that you will prioritize?
Well, we're focused on winning the election and making the case to the American people in 63
what case?
Days, yeah. I believe, that in order to move this country in a different direction, in order to actually... focus on the issues that matter in order to begin to end this national nightmare. We've got to fire the Republicans who are currently in charge of the House and in the Senate.
What is the point of this press conference? Like, dude, just stay in your office.
The the agenda is that we have to defeat the Republicans. That's what he's essentially saying.
We got to go out and make the case.
Right.
Which case? Just
a case.
The case. You know, what case?
Yeah.
We're going to make a case. We're going to fire people and...
Fire people, which just means we want to defeat Republicans.
And these are the things that actually matter.
Right.
Which I won't say what those are.
Yeah. You're going to have to elect...
Don't you hate it when a movie trailer gives away the whole plot?
Yes, yeah. Right. You know? You're going to have to elect us to find out.
67 days to make the case.
Tune in next week on The Democrats.
But will the Democrats make America more affordable? Tune in next week.
His movie trailer is like, in a world
right.
where there's a world... encompassed by a world. That world exists. Actually, the world exists.
Things will happen
That's
in
the
this movie.
Movie trailer. And this movie's going to be one that you really want to see.
Right. It's like ending an episode without a cliffhanger and then being like, you've got to tune in next week. You've got to see what happens. It's like, we don't care about what happens.
It's just honestly, like, I just don't understand what, when they sat down and said, let's have a press conference.
Or so you printed that, out the big so, posters.
So that we... We need people to come and see these posters. So what you're going to do is you're going to stand up there and make it look like you're going to answer questions. And then they'll see the posters.
Right. They won't have any questions after they see these posters.
What if they actually ask questions?
You guys are asking a lot of questions that are already answered by my posters.
Right.
Good.
Fire the Republicans who are currently in charge of the House and in the Senate. We have made clear that we're going... to aggressively focus on making life more affordable. And I think
aggressively focus
in the areas where we know there is uniform Democratic support. We have to reverse the Medicaid cuts.
Okay.
We should extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits. We should restore congressional authority as it relates to tariffs, because the Trump tariffs are making life more expensive for the American people. And we should end decisively, if it's still going on, Donald Trump's reckless and costly war of choice in the Middle East. These are issues that we know unite Democrats. But I don't want to get out ahead of the caucus, because there are a whole host of things that need to be worked on. We've established 5 working groups on affordability. A working group
Is Kushner in any
on housing. A working group on health care, a working group on child care, a working group on groceries and goods, and a working group on gas and utilities. And I look forward to interacting with the co-conveners of those working groups over the next few weeks as they present ideas to the caucus about the types of concrete legislative proposals that we can aggressively lean into should the American people give us the ability to govern in the majority in the next Congress.
Okay, let me translate.
Mm-hmm. I have a new graph.
We don't have any ideas yet, but we're working. We have an idea to get some ideas.
We're and when
we
drop a conversation
ideas,
nuke all gonna... over this Capitol.
I mean, look, reversing the Medicaid cuts, yes. Extend the expired ACA tax credits, yes. Restore Congress's authority on tariffs, yes. Decisively end the Iran war, yes. But what he's explaining is taking us back to the place
yep.
in 2024 when the Democrats lost everything. We're going to have ideas on how to get back to where we were when we lost the House
yeah.
and when we lost the presidency.
The way he said, like, this is what we can get the entirety of the caucus behind, which, like, I hope you can get the entirety of your caucus behind ending decisively the Iran war, for instance. I hope I can take that for granted. But it's so limited. You should be able to get people more on the same page of things that are actually, like, moving the ball forward.
But or... maybe the idea is for you to get out ahead of the caucus as you are the majority leader if they win.
But this is the agenda cycle. Now we have this.
Oh, don't come up with a new one.
It's a new one.
We already have the mugs.
This is not for merch. This is not for merch, Gino. But this is the agenda. Reverse, restore, extend, end. And you just go in the cycle like that. Is there anything proactive about anything that you're going to be establishing in the future when you look at that? This
are you aggressively extending? Are you violently reversing? Is it a concrete extension?
Right. I have not added a qualifier to talk about how I'm doing these actions with such gumption. But none of this is forward thinking. This is why I made this. This is all backwards thinking. Reverse, restore, extend, end. Reverse, restore, extend, and what about building something?
Proactive. Well, I also have a question.
Yeah.
Why is it when we are, his big statement was we're 63 days out from the election. That was the most concrete thing he said. Why is he waiting to 63 days out from an election to solicit ideas from people as to what we should do? It feels like this would have been a good thing to do back in February. You guys got 30 days, 45 days, the secret commissions that we've established to come up with ideas on what we need to. I mean, it feels like one of the two parties should have an agenda if they take power that exists more than 6 weeks before they win an election. It just sort of feels like that. You didn't have to tell us. You could have been waiting to tell us, this week.
And perhaps there could be more even of an emphasis if you don't want to do agenda items in particular, because you're still going to have Trump as the president no matter what, who would veto anything. Perhaps you could talk about holding this criminal administration to account so aggressively. You know, you're not going to aggressively listen or whatever. Actually go be aggressive in going after the criminals in this administration instead of meeting with one of them off book.
After you condemn the DSA.
And Hassan.
First, please.
This guy could have been hammering and emphasizing that there is a wife beater right now, Max Miller, that is being protected by Mike Johnson. And instead, they're focused more on condemning socialism and the DSA and Hassan than Abdul al-Sayed, and making sure that, they discipline him for campaigning with him. Then that's what's coming out of this. It's like when Nancy Pelosi censured Ilhan Omar over it's all about the Benjamins, yep. Which seems hilarious at that was called anti-Semitic at the time. You're Streisand affecting this, and these are members of your own caucus, and Republicans would never do this.
I will say, on a positive note, if Jeffries is as weak and bereft of ideas at this stage, then it is helpful when you have perhaps the most progressive House caucus we're going to have in a while.
Mm-hmm.
That is coming into office, because it means that no one's coalesced around any policies yet. And so, I mean, this is why, just in general, the idea of having institutions on the left that are developing policies is so important, because, as you can see, it's like they have not been doing that.
Right.
He's literally just said, I have set up a mechanism to solicit ideas for what we could do if we get into power.
We could lean into them.
And we could lean into them, and we're being aggressive
right.
in conversing about what we may converse about. We're in the ideation. Well, actually, we've ideated a mechanism in which to ideate more. And the product of that ideation will be something that we're going to look at seriously
mm-hmm.
if we win in 60 3 days.
If you add an adjective to the verbs that you're saying you're going to do, that makes it sound more aggressive than it is, then you're able to trick people.
I'm going to aggressively
sit down.
Add an adjective
right
to my verb or an adverb.
Right. That makes it sound a lot
tougher. I mean, if affordability is such an urgent issue that it's like the main thing you're talking about ahead of the midterms here, and you have to take meetings with Jared Kushner about it and expect us to believe that, shouldn't
you
have
that's part of my
done?
Ideation. I'm meeting with Jared Kushner, see if he has ideas about affordability that we could do.
Like, we're going to make the case, but also we don't know what the case is yet because we've got working groups
and
about the
what
case.
What the hell has he been doing? What has he been doing? Like, he doesn't want to get out ahead of the caucus. Dude, you're the guy who's supposed to know where your caucus is.
Well, that's where we're here today on this news story about what happened with Glusenkamp, Perez, and Golden.
You know, it's one thing to say, like, look, I need to, I don't want to get out ahead of the caucus. I want to be able to present bills that we're going to be able to pass. But what have you been doing? What have you been doing?
So, just to rant about this for a second, Nancy Pelosi was no leftist, no friend of the left, but no one really is able to say anything about her ability to understand where her caucus is and her ability to keep them in line. She did that with great effect. She understood it. Hakeem Jeffries yesterday had an immense moment of professional embarrassment. If we could just pull up what Jake Sherman, I sent this here, pointed out. This is what MGP, Mary Glusenkamp Perez, and Jared Golden, who was retiring, two Democrats, what they did, and they joined Republicans on this rules vote, which allowed the House to vote on these four different things. A bill condemning socialism, which they debated on the House floor for a while, giving them the ability to, Free media to attack the left, and then they got goodies protecting Domestic Mining Act, Northeast Lobstermen Protection Act, which is ostensibly what Golden wanted, but in the end, Golden wants to cash out once he leaves Congress, protect economic and academic freedom. Of course, it's related to Israel, prevents federally supported universities from boycotting Israel. So some people are saying that this is what the Democrats do all the time. Oh, they have rotating villains. The National Defense Authorization Act, like, for example, which funds the Pentagon. Conveniently, they can find 6 or 7 Democrats every time to get it just across the finish line. That is not what's happening here, in my opinion. Pentagon funding, that's like a huge bipartisan blob agreed upon bill that there is frequently precedent for the rotating villain thing to be happening. This is so unprecedented that you have Capitol Hill reporters talking about how embarrassing this is for a minority leader. This should be the number one thing he should be able to do, is to understand where his caucus is at, to whip them. And by all indications, Jeffries was taken by surprise that two members of his caucus voted for a rule and, voted with the Republicans. And in response to this, Hakeem Jeffries said, quote, "You'll have to talk to Catherine." That is him passing the buck and blaming Catherine Clark, the minority whip, who is in Democratic leadership, and saying that to the press about another member of the senior leadership team in the House. It's what NFL quarterbacks say before they're going to get benched. They blame their receivers. They blame their protection. They'll blame their coach, right? It's just fundamentally poor leadership. And Catherine Clark, people may remember, called Israel's actions a genocide on camera and then quickly backed away from it. But there have been some splinters there, seemingly within leadership, which also indicates how weak Jeffries is right now. But yeah, if you think I'm exaggerating, there was a reporter from Puck News who called it unprecedented in modern times to have the minority help the majority pass a rule. And Nancy Pelosi herself, even though Jeffries was her handpicked successor, had a quote about how if she were speaker and then trailed off, saying, "We didn't even consider that anyone would do that. We never had that problem, so I'm disappointed that they did that." She's trying not to blame Jeffries there, but of course it falls at Jeffries' feet, because this is just rank incompetence. This is so professionally embarrassing for him, and it's an indication that he's not just ideologically out of step with where the base is and where the party needs to go. He's also not effective at the nuts and bolts of his job.
So just so you know the details here, the vote was 210 to 208. These two made the difference. And really, frankly, you know, one of them made the difference. Because if one of them votes 209 to 209, then a tie defeats a rules vote. Supposedly, neither Golden or Glusenkamp, Perez, let the leadership know. Last night, Jeffries said that he had asked the caucus committee on caucus rules to consider punishing Jared Golden and MGP in the wake of that. Now, that's good. This is how you enforce party discipline. They obviously didn't have fears of this beforehand. MGP in particular should be severely punished.
Like, because she's running for re-election. Golden doesn't care.
Right. Golden doesn't care. But I imagine that there are things like you can do like, no lobbying for, 18 months. Who knows what it is. But he needs to do this to actually start to have some party discipline. And it is quite clear. Let's also be clear on this. Whenever there's a defection like this, whenever there is a small group of Democrats who defect, it is always, always members of the Blue Dog Coalition or the New Democrat Coalition or whatever, the so-called moderates. Those are the ones who sabotage this stuff, and they need to be disciplined.
Well, let's focus more on the DSA then and say how the DSA and Hassan Piker can't be in our tent. But apparently, you know who can be? People who go over to the Republican side to allow them to vote on rules condemning socialism and going after universities that student body wants them, when they pay tuition to these institutions, to stop using those funds to integrate itself with Israel, a country committing genocide.
And here's, I mean, again, this is, there is value in having a weak leader if you are trying to build power for an insurgency within the power, within the party. But just listen to this paragraph from The Guardian. The episode is to expose deeper strains inside a Democratic caucus that has struggled to project unity since its losses in the 2024 election. Asked whether the two lawmakers would face consequences, Jeffries told reporters on Tuesday that the matter was under discussion.
Oh, aggressively under discussion?
They just have, quote, under discussion. So they could have dropped the adjective beforehand, like severely under discussion. By the evening, Clark and Aguilar, who is, I think, the chair of the Rules Caucus, had escalated that to a formal referral. Maybe Aguilar is just in the leadership. But the point being that, like, the moment they vote for that, he is going to say, we're going to figure out a way of punishing them. I mean, and again, like,
maybe they should have known that before they made that vote.
Well, exactly.
Like, this is where he's a bad leader. And yep. I think this is bad for the moderates. Like, the Congressional Progressive Caucus continues to be, you know, look good in the eyes of the regular Democratic voter. And the centrists are tearing themselves apart a little bit here.
I mean, I think that's true within the context of the of the caucus, which is really, you know, 99.9% of Democratic voters will have absolutely no idea about this.
Yeah.
And but within the context of the caucus, you know, if they're not punished and it's not a real punishment, like a loss of like a committee seat or something to that effect, this is going to empower people like this to do this stuff again.
And in turn, this has very important propaganda value for where this party needs to go. We talked about the Kushner meeting yesterday, and we're integrating it into our coverage of this because this story has a significant shelf life. And I'm hearing just kind of normie Democrats talking about it as well. Like, the Democrats keep saying, because they want to avoid the ideological battle, we want fighters, right? That's just like baseline. My girl Haley Stevens was trying that. Like, she was aggressively running through walls to vote to protect tax credits or something like that. But she would use the tone of somebody that was fighting at the very least. And it's not, you know, she came kind of close in that primary. Even the most conservative Democratic voter right now doesn't want you meeting with Jared Kushner, does not want you appeasing these criminals. It's a massive misread of the mood. So I think extending that story to weaken him and allow him to bleed out support is helpful. And then also showing that he's incompetent at his job. Pelosi would have never let this happen with the millions of problems that I have with her. She would have never let this happen. He's weak right now. And how do we get... although I guess I didn't see this picture yet. Now I've changed my mind.
Be careful.
Here we go. Put this up.
Oof.
I'd be Ken Klippenstein. Yeah.
Ken made this?
Don't talk shit if you ain't ready for a strongly worded
letter. And the interesting thing, keep the picture up there. The cool thing about this bat, it's actually a giant pen.
Wow.
It's crazy how holding the bat can diminish
it. Got that at Cooperstown.
He's riding it like a brewmaster.
Exactly. Isn't it like this?
He looks like a bat boy. Like, hey,
at the other end.
Hey, yeah. Bambino, I got your bat here for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but look at this picture. Look how closely they're holding these conversations.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
That's a tight circle.
Exactly.
That is what an aggressive conversation looks like.
I'm uncomfortable.
I know. What are they doing playing spin?
A struggle session.
Spin the bottle? But I mean, I don't know. I think it's a problem. I think it's a problem for them, and we'll see, and hopefully.
One thing's for sure is Jeffries is a problem for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, the point is that Jeffrey has to apply an actual punishment here. There has to be a price to be paid if you undermine the caucus in this way. And the only thing I can imagine is that there is like some concern that Jeffries has in that if he does, and they'll parse it in this way, but if he does apply a punishment, there's going to be an expectation that he applies this punishment when you have other Democrats defect in specific votes. They're going to parse it out at like, well, this is a rules vote, so it's a very different thing.
Yeah,
and it certainly is. You know, no politician is going to pay a price, for better or for worse, for voting one way or another on a rules vote. You're not going to have a big movement in your district. You're the guy who voted against or for the rules vote. I want to just read this off because yesterday we covered this story from the Washington Post in the context of speaking to Dara Lind, who was talking about the revocation of temporary protected status for up to 1 million people, 350,000 of whom are Haitian immigrants. All of these people are in this country legally. They have a legal status under our law. It was revoked unilaterally, despite the fact that Haiti is still so dangerous that our own government has said we are not allowing flights into Haiti's capital because of how dangerous the gang situation is there. And one of these people who had their temporary protected status revoked was a 20-year-old man, Pierre Delmas Bell. He was from Springfield, Ohio. He came into the country in 2024. His parents were already here. He was reunited with them. He was I think, had signed up for or was already a member of the junior ROTC, had a job, was going to school, played soccer. I think it was community college soccer. I'm not quite sure. And he was given an ankle bracelet.
For the crime of being
For the crime
Haitian.
Of being Haitian. And
it was in an alternative to detention program they were doing.
Because they can't, they don't have room, to frankly, for all these people. And he had apparently begged, well, I'm going to read this note from his father. Yesterday or 2 days ago, it appears that Pierre Adamas Bell drove onto a highway, stepped out of his car, and walked into traffic to kill himself. This is the transcript of the note that his father wrote. After my son was outfitted with his ankle monitor, he felt like he was treated like an animal. He took two trips to Cincinnati and Westerville to plead to the officers to remove the bracelet since he's a soccer player and he felt embarrassed and humiliated when he's among his classmates at the university. He was bullied a lot, telling him he's a criminal. Last Friday, August 28th, he told me, "Dad, I felt humiliated since they gave uniforms to all my classmates at JROTC, their uniform, but except me because of the bracelet. This morning he left the house before 8 a.m. He called me at 8:03 on the video call mentally because I don't feeling okay, and I told him, come home so that we can talk. I had my youngest to take to school. I took him to school. By the time I got around 11 a.m., police showed up my door to report that he threw himself under a truck." Yeah, this is an Instagram post that he put up, I guess it was, and he wrote, "I came to this country to pursue my education. I didn't come here to commit a crime or hurt anyone. Yet now I'm walking through the streets of the United States with a GPS monitor on my leg, carrying a feeling of shame and humiliation I never imagined I would experience. I came here to study, to build my future, and to live a better, not to be treated like a criminal. So how am I supposed to play college sports with a GPS monitor on my leg?" You know, this is happening to literally hundreds of thousands of people, in this country right now.
The humiliation is so unbelievable and undeserved and sadistic and racist.
And the point.
And I'd also say all this, you know, stuff we're hearing from Marjorie Taylor Greene, the right wing turned against Israel. Y'all have nothing on Israel. Yeah. Like, you are no better. you are the exact same fascists, the exact same people disgracing this entire world.
I mean, it's, you know, it reminds me of the Foucault panopticon a bit, in the sense of like this, the psychological torture that constantly feeling monitored and watched when that's inflicted upon somebody, what the effect that has. There's that, the surveillance element, but then there's also, of course, the othering and the humiliation. And I think of trans kids right now as well, who are being also humiliated by the state for reasons of hierarchy and racism in the instances of our immigration system, but also, of course, homophobia and transphobia with trans people.
We've created the number one. There's never been a more budgeted federal law enforcement agency than ICE, and this is what they're doing.
We should say, you know, in our talk yesterday with Dara Lind, this is all by design. That is, I'm quite sure that ICE is perfectly happy with somebody throwing themselves under a bus, yep, because it achieves what they want to achieve, which is to create terror in these communities.
And it gives their base something to cheer on.
Yep.
I mean, look at the comments of that. This stuff. Those Nazis are all over it.
And there is a reason why July and August have had record-breaking number of arrests. And you can see what that what constitutes an arrest. We flip a switch and we make hundreds of thousands of people illegal that weren't illegal 2 weeks ago and are today. And that's where they get their arrests. And they're doing it because they want to show their voters that they're doing what they promised them. Colorado.
Meanwhile, Hakeem Jeffries is bragging about how they got rid of Kristi Noem as if it stopped anything and as if Democrats had anything to do with Kristi Noem getting
right,
fired.
Right, exactly.
Can we just put up four just to make this case here? Because as Sam's saying, this is what the base wants. If you believed that there was this sort of ethnic cleansing campaign for immigration purposes was going to result in some sort of economic growth, I have a bridge to sell you, although you've already probably been scammed by Bitcoin or something like that if you're that goddamn dumb. Here is a chart here about where the crackdowns on ICE arrests have been heaviest. Shows actually immigrant sector pay, the sector that was supposedly going to be helped by this racist ethnic cleansing campaign by ICE, has had the slowest pay growth. So there is absolutely zero coalition with ICE enforcement arrests terrorizing immigrant communities and so-called, you know, real Americans getting some sort of wage gains from this. In fact, the economy is continuing to go in the opposite direction.
The correlation is actually the opposite.
Yeah.
Construction and hospitality wage growth sinks the higher the number of ICE arrests per 100,000 people.
I thought they were taking jobs.
Of course. I mean, we had somebody IM in yesterday. ICE came in, arrested our, I don't know if it was they were framers or they were, mutters.
Yeah.
Now
no one can work.
You arrest the framers, then the guys who put the drywall up, they can't put the drywall up. The guys who are doing the taping, they can't do the taping. The guys who are doing the electric, they can't run the electric if there's no studs. I mean, that's what's happening. You're shutting down construction in these areas and hospitality. And I would also bet that you may see a similar correlation in like nursing home pay. I mean, the fact of the matter is like this is and there are reports and we will find out later. I mean, it's very hard because the IRS is so severely understaffed, but I will bet you a year from now, we will look at receipts from 2025 and 2 years from now, we will look at tax receipts from 2026 and they will be down. Despite the fact that supposedly there's been any expansion to GDP, they will be down because the amount of wages that are being earned is less, and it will show literally the loss of all the taxes that immigrants paid.
Karen Finney, CNN political commentator, points out that if he were a young white man from South Africa, Trump's government would be paying him $4,500, no strings
doubled,
attached.
Doubled. They doubled the funding for white South Africaners.
Just explicitly white nationalist, white supremacist policy being enacted.
Well, let's talk about another sort of poor immigrant who suffered from this as well. Obviously, and we should say this beforehand, I don't believe that Milo Yiannopoulos should have been targeted because he has told tales about all the right wingers, who had fake fake views because he criticized Laura Loomer and spilt the beans on Tim Pool's show that Her dad had had her committed twice in California, and at one point
that's why she can't buy a gun.
That she's not Jewish and has been pretending to be Jewish.
Yeah,
and that she was bragging that she had orally copulated the president of the United States. Well, I didn't want to say the guy's name because it's just too explicit
right.
at that point.
Move on.
I'd much rather have dog food.
Me too.
But we should also, we should keep in mind throughout all of this that Milo Yiannopoulos. Let's just start with his tweet, because people should know the context in which he is going on to Piers Morgan in presumably in London, because he'd been deported to England, to the place where he's from, which is a bonus because a lot of people, there are Cuban refugees in Florida sent to Central Africa. There are people from Mexico sent to El Salvador. There
Afghans
are
as well.
Afghans sent to Africa. You know,
they're trying to take a Mahmoud Khalil. They're trying to deport him to Algeria when he's just out of cruelty.
But here is Milo. Just 1 year ago today, almost to the day.
Yeah, 11 months ago, basically.
These are the people performatively weeping and crying on CBS News as ICE drags them off to be deported. And your mom and sister are choked up and saying shit like maybe we could have had an amnesty. He is, you know, talking obviously about people being deported and showed very, very little sympathy for these people. However, like every conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Milo Yiannopoulos, despite the fact that he's been catty and undermining some on the right, really just out of petty personality clashes, he now has seen the light of how inhumane the Trump policy is. Can you believe it?
From firsthand experience.
Hmm.
A collapse into this ugly, warmongering, you know, taken as a whole, mentally ill heap of crazy, with some of the most, you know, unstable and lunatic people seemingly directing the president's actions. If I had any clue that anything remotely like this, you know, was even possible, I would never
pause
have
it for
got involved.
A clue, huh? Is there really no, like,
there are
no
clues.
When he was working with Kanye...
or Marjorie.
When he was working for Marjorie Taylor Greene, or when he was Laura Loomer's communications director, was there really no clue as to the insanity in this administration? Was it like Stephen Miller? There was no clue? Was there really no clue?
It was like the usual suspects. Like, now, well, now you put it together.
Right.
Yes. Go ahead.
If I had any clue that anything remotely like this, you know, was even possible, I would never have got involved in supporting Trump in the first place. And I'm very ashamed that I did.
I don't think so.
Let's go to
I think this is seven. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't really understand the physical reality of how institutionalized the brutality is in America. The manner in which they arrest you, they put you in manacles, your hands, your feet, chained together. I mean, like, it is, everybody is arrested is like an MS-13 gang member, and it hurts a lot more than it looks like on television. You know, I was put from detention facility to a correction facility. You know, every 3 hours they were sort of trying to keep ahead of my lawyers so I couldn't, so whatever. But no one would tell me anything. I mean, I know it's designed to be like that, but it was humiliating and it was disorientating, all the rest of it. It was physically degrading. It was frightening. It was frightening. I don't think I've ever been frightened like that before. Just not.
How emotional have you been through this period?
I've never been like this before. I tripped and kind of tumbled down the stairs a night or two ago, and you know, I'm a clumsy person, so that it's not the rarest thing in the world. But it set something off from when I'd been kind of, you know, shoved down a couple of steps, and I was weeping like an old woman for an hour. And I was like, oh, I really have got to get this out of my system. I think maybe in the past I've been a little bit blasé when people talked about the trauma, a little bit kind of cavalier when people talked about, you know, stuff kind of lingering with them. But I get it now. I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
Although you actually have literally wished it on people.
Wished on, like, basically everyone. I wouldn't
again wish it. And in fact, not only have you literally in the past wished it upon people, you actively, materially aided in that happening to people.
Last September, he posted total legal immunity for ICE agents when they're on duty. Justice system should just be, it should be just ICE. Justicism should be just ICE is what he posted last September. That's the justice system.
Well,
that
had he known,
faced.
He would have.
I know, there were no
that
clues.
That was maybe
fact,
a little bit blasé.
Piers Morgan, number 8, reminds him of this stuff. And let's see, now that he's been able to realize the error of his ways of being blasé when people have spoken about trauma in the past, I wonder if he will take responsibility for some of his comments in the past. My guess is no.
The criticism against you is a charge of hypocrisy, because people say, well, look, you spent a lot of time supporting publicly ICE being very aggressive with deportations. On January the 2nd, 2025, you posted punishing Somalis indiscriminately as a group and deported them all as the only way this administration will persuade the voters it is serious and up to the job. And then again in May 25, there's one concrete thing we must insist on this administration delivering. It matters a lot more than debts measured in imaginary money. We've got to deport millions and millions of people. Without that, nothing else matters. In September 2025, total legal immunity for ICE agents when they're on duty. And 21st of September 2025, justice system should be just ICE. So there you are aggressively promoting ICE being very aggressive and demanding that millions of people be deported. People say, Milo, you've been hoisted by your own petard.
And I don't have a word to say. You got me. I'm very... look,
I mean, they're doing funny. What you told them to do. Deport millions of people.
Well, not really.
It just happened to include you.
They're not doing it lawfully. And I think...
You did say about Somalis, they should be deported indiscriminately.
I'm obviously exaggerating.
Deporting them all.
Obviously exaggerating there. I think another tweet, I said something like, you know, we shouldn't let the 97% of Somalis, create a bad reputation for the, you know, for the law-abiding 3%. I tell all kinds of...
No, but the point...
I just want you to just recognize what just happened there. He said I was joking when we should, in general, get rid of all Somalis. Yeah. And his defense was, well, I can prove that I was joking because I've made other just as reprehensible jokes about Somalis, implying that 97% of them were all criminals. In this moment where he has tried to sort of like, he's obviously on here looking for sympathy. I mean, you know.
Or and attention, which is his number one
attention.
Drug.
But sympathy and attention. He could have come on here and been like, I don't give a crap and get me again, deport me again. I don't care. I'll sneak back. He could have been, but he was looking for sympathy.
Some cynical people think it's a troll, but another elaborate troll by him. But I don't think so.
Well, what, that he actually got deported?
Or that he's like trying to do this about face as some sort of troll to turn around.
What about,
what
about faces here?
I'm agreeing. This is just a classic case of a conservative who couldn't have empathy for anybody until it happened to them, which we've seen endless times.
But even in this moment where he is faced with his cheerleading for this stuff, never mind again. There was no mystery as to what the Trump administration was going to do. They were talking about mass deportations before. Very easy, particularly for a guy who's involved in politics, right? This is not a civilian.
Yeah.
This is not somebody This is not some like immigrant who was hoodwinked and thought like, oh, I thought they were only going to get rid of the criminals. That's what you know, filtered down to me. This is a guy who knew exactly what the plan was. And 5 minutes of Googling, he could have found out. Yeah, here's the mass deportation now. 5 minutes of... They literally printed up signs.
Right. Well, wait.
Golden girl and the popcorn guy?
I'm not wearing my glasses. Does that say just the criminals and Trende Aragua in Aurora and only people that are causing violence and we're going to be very non-discriminatory towards racial and ethnic groups? That's what that sign said, right?
And the point is that like he certainly knew how many criminals were in there. But the fact is, and he's going to go on, I think, in this clip, to talk about how they hoodwinked him and they took away his legal status without telling him. I got news for you, Chief. Based upon everything in your party, you're an illegal. That's your crime. You're in the country illegally. He's claiming that they're being illegal. No, dude. You got exactly what you advocated for. You just didn't think like you thought you were protected.
There was some white area in the argument.
He's protected by his whiteness. And the fact that they're going after Somalis in particular makes this so abundantly clear. It lays it bare. It betrays their true motivation because that group actually has some of the highest citizenship rates of any immigrant group in this country, Somalis. So when they talk about Somalis in particular, it's twofold. They get to be Islamophobic, anti-black, or I guess threefold, and anti-immigrant. And when they go after who they this group that appears to have some of the highest rates or is the less vulnerable, they're showing that it really is about ethnic cleansing and white purification of the country.
And he's out here complaining that he was just targeted sort of like almost, by whim, not according to the rule of law. Give me an effing break, dude. You're as guilty as anybody else who's been sent out of there. And the only reason why you're complaining is because you thought you had a white get out of immigration laws free card. Good.
Create a bad reputation for the law abiding 3%. I tell all kinds of mean spirited exaggerated jokes.
Right, but
ISIS is supposed to be deporting criminals.
I understand, Martin.
They're supposed to be prioritizing people who come in illegally.
I know.
Who sell people.
I understand.
Who murder.
Minor,
who rape. Who sell drugs.
I get it.
Not doing that.
I get it. The problem you have, I think, in these tweets and public statements.
Oh, pause it. Hold on for a second. Pause it for a second. ICE has been doing this stuff for a year and a half. Will you pull up the tweet where he complains about ICE not going after the criminals?
Zero results came back.
Oh, weird. Weird. Go ahead.
Tweets and public statements is that you weren't singling out Somali criminals, for example, or just criminals. You wanted Somalis as a group. All deported.
No.
You said that. Yeah, but you said that.
I was
you can't deny saying it.
No, of course not. I'm not.
So the argument against you goes, well, Milo, you know, you didn't care about Somalis being legally or illegally there. You wanted them all thrown out.
Generalizing about groups that have rampant criminality. I don't think British ghostwriters are an especially egregiously violent
British
group
ghost
of people. Every single one of those facilities I was taken to, I was put in a huge line of cells in which there was nobody.
But that seems to me an argument for deporting more people like you.
Well, I don't think like me, but maybe deporting more people in general.
What? Oh
my God. Whoops.
I think England should deport him to Greece.
The best part for me was when Piers Morgan, and I don't know if you have this clip, I may not have put it in there, where he got caught. Apparently, he's still married to his husband.
Who's an American.
He had claimed at one point that they were just roommates. But he did make a point of saying, we don't have sex. Which, you know, based upon my experience in marriage, is probably the most credible thing he said. But, be that as it may. Go ahead.
Why would I lie? It's going to make it even more difficult for me to get back to see my family, back to see my pets, my...
So what family do you have back in America at the moment? Your wife?
Well, I'm married to an American. I've got dependents. I've got cats. I've got, you know, I've got employees. I have a whole life there. I've been there for 10 years.
Not a wife? You know,
everything is there.
You're married to an American woman?
No.
Man? I don't want to pry into your sexuality.
Yeah, I don't.
I know you've... Yes. I mean, you're a gay man and you're married to a gay man.
Go back a little bit.
Wow, what? Like, he made a huge stink of, like, we're no longer married, we're just roommates.
Hmm.
Milo, nobody believed that. You don't need to, like...
It's just so bizarre.
You know, he's really lost his ability to be more evasive without those sunglasses.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, he should put...
Can you open your eyes?
Their eyes are going in a bunch of different directions.
Like, I'm just, like, sort of, like, this is just so fascinating at this point where he is so ashamed of himself in some way. I don't know. Does he
married to an American?
Do you think it's, like a defense? Like, whoever it is that he's a... He's obviously very reluctant to say that he's married to a guy. And the why is sort of fascinating. Like, is he embarrassed by that? Is he ashamed? Is he afraid that he has some type of, like, conservative constituency that, whether it's, like, fans who, I don't know, read his Substack, or if it's just, like, from a business perspective, he can't go into certain conservative circles because he's gay. I mean, look, 25 years ago, the whip, I can't remember his name, from California, a Republican, cannot remember his name now in the House, but he was a gay man, and there was, like, at least a dozen Republican congressmen who would not even shake his hand 20 years ago. No, I don't think it was Emmer. It was another guy.
Emmer's now.
This is like in 2004. But nevertheless, like, so it's fascinating as to what. And then he thinks that somehow those people that he's trying to give plausible deniability that he's still gay.
Yeah, not cancel their recurring donations.
He goes on to say that, well, I don't have sex. We don't have sex. Which is also fascinating because, like, I got news for you. It's not just the sex. They don't want you married to a guy.
Yeah.
They don't like the idea that you could be in love or in partnership with a guy.
Even give him a smooch.
Or even if you're married just to have certain citizenship status. If you're not having sex with them, it sounds like that's the kind of immigration marriage that they also talk about.
It's also indicative of, like, how long it takes probably to get citizenship.
Yes, and also I don't believe him that they don't have sex. Let's just put that out there with his husband. I don't believe he and his husband.
Well, I don't know. He's denying his existence. I bet you it's probably not as hot as it used to be. At least
let's just play it out.
Don't
watch
set
him,
Sam, up again.
Watch him. Watch him say. Watch him say. We don't have sex though.
Pry into your sexuality.
Yeah, I don't.
I know you've. I mean, you're a gay man, and you're married to a gay man.
I don't do the sex stuff anymore, but yes.
Okay. I'm only asking because I just want to know what family you have left in America.
Yeah.
Where is your
I don't do
spouse?
The sex stuff anymore.
Living in the same. Why would I lie? It's going to make it.
Why would I lie? That's because you were literally just caught in a lie about not being gay anymore. Found out you're married to a man.
British people do so well in American media because I think they can intimidate with their, like, indigenous grip of the language. But right. When they go over to England and they face him like Piers Morgan, somebody, like, he's own... melted rust.
Well,
yeah.
Also, I had news for you. Piers Morgan specifically said, you left your American wife there.
Yeah.
Piers Morgan knew.
Oh, well, he's a caddy.
He's destroyed Russell Brand and Milo, two British people who came over here.
Who dazzle Americans with their accent.
Can you just pull up this one graph before we wrap the segment just to show, like, that I just sent? This is Austin Coker. And these are not raw totals, but this is just as a share of percentage of ICE. It's the second chart in this. Here it is. This one. Share of ICE administrative arrest by criminality at apprehension. And it starts from the end of the Biden administration to now. So I know that Milo's out there looking for clues. Inspector, what's his name? Clouseau over here. But this clue might have been helpful for him. Look at that precipitous decline from October 2024 to August in convicted criminal and pending criminal charges. Again, I would also include that pending criminal charges does not make you a criminal in this country. Charges does not mean that you were found guilty in a court of law, but I guess we abandon that for people who are immigrants who live in a sub-citizen status. But look at that share of other immigration violator. And by violator, that doesn't mean necessarily violator. That can mean somebody who's here legally under temporary protected status, for example. So there's a clue for Milo Yiannopoulos if he needs it.
Trump has new Truth Social I thought we might want to look at here. Now that we have it under USA control, should we change the name Hormuz Strait to Trump Strait? Like America itself, it will be hotter than ever before. Thank you for your attention on this matter, President Donald J. Trump.
How many times are we going to do this renaming thing?
He's going to keep doing it because Google and Apple now call it Lake America.
Let's nationalize those companies.
It was David Dreyer. That was the name of the whip at that time.
I honestly, if we can get Google to call the Strait of Hormuz Trump Strait and it gets us out of the Iran war.
Yeah, whatever. Sure.
I don't give a shit what it's called.
I would love it. I would love it. It's the Trump Strait.
Of course they're charging fees because it's now the Trump Strait.
Right.
It's so hot that even Iran gets to charge fees on it.
Right. Everyone wants a piece of the Trump Strait.
David Dreyer, I guess, was the chairman of the Rules Committee. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. We will take your phone calls.
I think Roy Blunt was the whip at that time. That's what I was finding.
That may be right. Should we do take a look. Harry Enten here? Since we're on the
oh wow, that is a funny find.
What's that?
What Enten is saying.
Yeah, this is interesting. Here's Harry Enten. Showing that despite the fact that people hate Trump and perceive Republicans correctly as basically being fluffers for Trump.
And extreme.
They still have the capacity to realize, like, Democrats are not stepping up. Having conversations about conversing and ideating in the future is just not a message that is making Democrats look good. They're looking good relative to Republicans, but the problem is at one point they're going to be judged on what they're going to do. Good.
Democrats are down on their knees. They're begging, please, please, please allow this election to be about Donald John Trump. Because if you can see this right now, Republicans are actually outperforming President Trump. Look at that. Choose Republicans for House. You get 41% of the electorate who say that. Approval of President Trump, he's only at 37%. So right now, Democrats are actually underperforming where they should be given where President Trump's popularity is. And Republicans are overperforming. Democrats are begging, please, President Trump, get involved in these midterm fights. We can do even better than we're doing right now. And of course, they are, in fact, leading right now on the generic congressional ballot by about 6, 7, or 8 points, depending on how you average the polls.
So if it is about Trump, you know, what are some of the numbers tell us there?
Yeah, okay. There's another reason that we know that Democrats want this election to be about President Trump. And the way we can see this is break down your congressional vote, right? The choice for Congress, if your vote is a message about Trump, either positive or negative. Look at this. Democrats lead by 27 points among those voters. 27 points. among all the other voters, the voters who say this is not, in fact, their vote is not, in fact, the message that they're trying to send about President Trump. Look at that. Republicans are leading by 19 points. So Democrats absolutely want this midterm to be about Trump, because the voters who say that their vote is about sending a message to Trump, Democrats are crushing. The voters who say it isn't, Republicans are actually the ones leading.
So if the president's trying to reach a higher number of voters with this message, hey, make the election about me, are there voters out there who might be attracted to that message who aren't already with him?
No. This is the whole thing, right? I think part of the reason he wants this to be about him is because maybe there's those Republican voters who would stay home. But if it's about me, hey, those are the ones who come out in presidential years, right? Maybe they'll come out in the midterm. But take a look here. Republicans' approval of President Trump. If you're already motivated to vote in 2026, right, your approval rating of Trump is 81%. If you look at those who are not made motivated to vote, those who aren't either extremely or very motivated to vote at this point, look at this. Republicans' approval of President Trump, their approval of President Trump is just 58%. The Republicans who are depressed right now are the ones who actually are far more likely to dislike the President of the United States. The ones who are already motivated to turn out and vote, they are the ones who like President Trump. So if you're going to motivate those Republicans on the sideline, the ones you're more likely to motivate are actually those who are more likely to dislike the President of the United States. Again, this is why Democrats are begging, please, 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 let's make this a midterm about President Trump, because the slew of data suggests that would be a very good midterm for them indeed.
Well, a couple months to go. What are the prediction markets saying about the odds for the House?
Yeah. Okay, who cares? But here's the point. These type of elections are always about a referendum on the party in power. Not always, but the vast majority of times are. However, the question is, do you want the option to be a drag or a lubricant to voting against this person? And it is quite clear the Democrats are a drag on that incentive. And Hakeem Jeffries going up and giving that kind of press conference he gave, basically saying, like, we're not going to tell you what we're going to do, but I can tell you that we're thinking about it. We're talking about it, or we're talking about talking about it. We're thinking about talking about it, and then we're going to see what we think once we start talking about it.
Aggressively.
First up, calling from a 308 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 308. Nope, we lost him. Calling from a 510 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? What's going on? They cannot hear me. Hello?
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 Is this me?
Yep. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now hear you.
Oh, yes. Awesome. Yes. This is Kamyar from Normal, Illinois. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. Love calling in, you guys. So I just kind of wanted to briefly talk about the news about the bombing that happened at that wedding.
Yep.
I don't think if I can't convince my family that what happened there is like indicative of everything that is like wrong with their opinions on the Iran war and Iran as a country and what they think it's doing and what they think any kind of positive outlook can come out of this, I'm going to just lose faith in just having any kind of productive conversation with them at all. It's honestly, that's one of the most disgusting things. Like the school bombing was already like a terrible, terrible, like inconceivable thing to like try to justify like any reason why this is like acceptable. Oh, it's in the proximity of a military base, or oh, it's you know, they were harboring some people. Like no, like those are ridiculous reasoning. But I think it gets to a point where I just have to sit them down and be like, if you can't agree with me that what is happening is no fault of the people there, it's no fault of the government, and you guys have to like actually speak out in your communities, because they talk to people that live there. They get information and get perspective from people that live there, and I don't have that perspective because I only have, and recently, and this is insane, I have a single contact of somebody who lives in Iran, complete stranger. I only know them because they're in a friend of a friend's Discord. They are somebody who used to work in the Strait. They were actually working in the Strait doing shipping work and like working at the ports. And they lost their job once the Strait closed. And all I know is that they regularly go out and loot because they can't afford anything. They don't have any way to like get money, so they just like take advantage of like a situation where like they just start looting because that's what they were stuck with doing. I don't know like how legitimate and like how pressing that particular instance is. It's just like it's just a guy, but his perspective too, it's so crazy. He shares the same perspective as some of my family members on this stuff, and it's just fascinating to me. But like I was able to have like a normal conversation with him from my perspective as like an Iranian born on U.S. soil to parents that left during the revolution. So sorry for rambling off a little bit, but like, yeah, I'm just like, I don't know what else to tell them. If I'm going to be visiting them over the weekend, and if I'm going to have this conversation with them and I'm going to ask them, what do you think? And if I start hearing like, you know, excuses that, oh yeah, no, they must have been harboring somebody in this private home. At this private event, I'm just going to lose my mind. It's untenable.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can tell you is that I never expect people to change their mind about these things overnight. And so, if you take the tact of you're just trying to plant a seed, that's all. I think you will find it will be easier for you to deal with. And let that seed,
grow. Did you mention your parents are Iranian diaspora, you said?
Yes, they are Iranian diaspora. They left during the revolution, and my mother, she's the only one in my family that I've convinced that everything that's happening there is like a very, very bad thing. So I'm glad there's at least that.
I mean, that's something to build off of. I mean, I've spoken to a number of, interviewed a number of different speakers on Iran, and particularly people who are in a situation like that where, you know, they'll criticize Iran and also criticize what America's policies towards Iran historically and currently. But often the most pushback they get is from members of the Iranian diaspora, who are an incredibly propagandized group of people.
Yeah, and, it's crazy.
Then, and also, you know, had material reasons, obviously, to leave the country. And, I can understand those resents, and you don't want anything that undermines or, you know, creates nuance in that when you're harboring that kind of resent.
Yeah, they haven't been in the country for the last 40 years. I have family members that like on the extended side that are actually huge Trump supporters, which is just the weirdest thing. I don't understand that at all, but it's just like, it's a normal thing apparently for diaspora Iranians to also just be straight up Trump supporters.
I mean, I think, listen, there was, I've come across this, you know, with folks I know of like a Puerto Rican background and, or a Mexican background where there are some, you know, particularly I think like older folks who want to be as American as possible, and you know, support of Trump in some way sort of like translates into that for them. And you know, who knows? But good luck, hang in there.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Sam. Thanks. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
Call from a 308 area code. We lost you last time. Who's this?
This is Kowalski calling from the great state of Nebraska.
That's what I thought. Kowalski from Nebraska. What's
Hello,
happening?
Kowalski.
I should tell you before you you speak. I have told Saul that I'm taking him to Nebraska next summer for a week. I will do the show from there, and he will work on your farm. I'm getting some pushback, but I don't know if I care.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, like, I learned how to operate heavy machinery when I was like 9 years old. So, I mean, he should be more than qualified.
Perfect.
What kind of animals do you have there?
Wait, what?
What kind of animals?
Just cattle. I mean, as long as he's not afraid of like a 1,200-pound mother and a 90-pound calf, like going in between the two, he should be fine.
That might be a little bit tricky, but he likes puppies. What do you got, Kowalski?
We don't do dogs. We have dogs. We have labs. We're lab people. Very basic. But so last night here in Nebraska, my hometown, where the state fair is currently going on, go there, get some food, feel bad about yourself. There was a debate between Pete Ricketts and Dan Osborne, and I have to say, on the whole, it wasn't very exciting. For the most part, Pete Ricketts came off very just attackative. So, like, he kept calling Dan Osborne Democrat Dan. He said it, like, 24 times throughout the night. And I was a little disappointed that Dan Osborne wasn't more aggressive, but maybe that's just on me because everything I've seen on social media showed that everybody seemed to like that. They just thought that he came off as more professional. He didn't sound like a Fox News pundit just saying buzzwords like Ricketts. So on the whole, I would say it was probably either a draw or maybe a minor win for Osborne. The one thing, though, that did irritate me, and this is the point of the whole call, I do not like Osborne's position on immigration. And I'm not sure if you guys heard much on that. I know you guys follow this. So.
I do recall not liking his position on immigration. And in fact, I think we've cited that as examples of things that we're not going to like about various candidates who, and I don't know if he's said that he's actually going to caucus with the Democrats. I think he has said he's not going to specifically caucus with the Democrats, but I imagine he's going to vote with them more often than not. But yeah, I think his immigration position is probably bad, but I will say, in terms of like impact, it's better than Ricketts, but B, part of the problem is, tell me what the Democratic position is on immigration.
You see, that's actually the point of why I'm calling. So, like, his deal is that he is, as part of his, like, marketing right now or campaigning message, he does openly blame Biden and Harris for an open borders policy during the Biden presidency, which I guess probably nullifies some of, like, those Republicans in the suburbs because of just the messaging they've been hit with. But do you know what year was the last time the United States had comprehensive immigration reform?
1986.
Wow.
November 6th of this year, it will have been 40 years since we have had comprehensive immigration reform in the United States.
Unreal.
That means our last time we've had immigration reform, there has been the formation of the European Union, the rise of China as a major industrial power, Japan becoming a stagnant power, Mexico becoming the most advanced developing nation in the world, and
fall of the
Canada
Soviet Union,
basically doubling its population.
Fall of the Soviet Union. Also,
wait, I'm the cut out there. What?
The fall of the Soviet Union has also happened in that time.
We're not sure.
Matlack was born.
It might still be there. Yeah, so the fall of the Soviet Union. My whole thing on this is that it is disappointing because if the Democrats actually had, like, a comprehensive immigration policy, that could be something that an independent like Osborne could piggyback off of. But it doesn't seem like there really is any plan like that, which to me sounds like they're being extremists because it just seems like a practical, you know, down-to-earth sense that you would need a policy to do immigration reform at this point. And you can even be cynical about it and be like, Well, we need to build off of Ronald Reagan's immigration policy. You all love the Republican Ronald Reagan, like that can work in suburbs. It's just, it's like a failure of imagination from all of these, like, I don't know. Maybe I should just go into being a campaign advisor for Democrats or something, because clearly I have this, like, a knack for this. I don't know. But, yeah, just something I've noticed.
No, it's absurd. You can't, if you have no articulable policy, and now Biden, you know, sent legislation to the House, and you know, Trump shut it down. But there's no articulable policy, so it becomes very easy for the Republicans to make one up and impart it to them. And so they need to come up with a like an articulable policy. And part of that it will involve like educating the American public as to the fact that like they don't understand what's going on. They're afraid because any policy that you you develop or propose is necessarily going to be more nuanced and sophisticated than whatever the Republicans say that your policy is, and frankly, what their policy is. And so the Democrats have just been afraid to expend any type of political capital on coming up with it. But the problem is that you start to accrue a debt. And if you leave a vacuum like this, and they have left the playing field on immigration for years. And Obama's answer,
the Republicans have essentially created a straw man, and they're being 100% Democrats are being forced to fight that straw man.
100
instead of actually coming up with a coherent policy that would force Republicans onto their heels,
yeah,
to actually address something 100%. Tangible. It would just be nice to see the Democrats do that.
And if you go back to like the Obama years, his strategy was like, we're going to look like we're really tough. Mm-hmm. On immigration by deporting a bunch of people. And then we're going to be able to negotiate with the Republican lawmakers. It's almost like if they think that like there is a blinkered version of like how these politics work, particularly when it comes to immigration. George Bush tried to pass a bill in 2005, I think it was. And he got completely blindsided by right-wing talk radio that reared up and basically scuttled the whole thing. Marco Rubio tried to, marshal a proposal, and he collapsed he folded like a deck chair. The Democrats need to articulate a policy and force Republicans to reject it. But that needs to be articulated. The words comprehensive immigration, strong borders alone doesn't do anything. It doesn't mean anything because the only thing that they're promoting, the only thing that they're highlighting from their own proposal is something that the Republicans do better as yep. far as people are concerned. They need to offer something that is explicit and different, and they're afraid to. Hopefully this...
I 100% agree. I do need to get going here, but I just wanted to shout out my channel tonight or tomorrow. I will have a video dropping on how we solve climate change. Don't worry, folks. I figured it out. We have whipped it. One stressor to take off your mind.
Very nice.
And then,
thanks for solving
relief.
That. Yeah.
And then, Emma, question.
Yeah.
How did the wedding go? And why are my DMs not blowing up?
I'm sorry, Kolsky. I forgot to spread the good word. The wedding went great. I gave a speech. I think it went quite well. It was
were
like
you supposed to mention Kowalski in the speech?
I didn't. I forgot to mention you in the speech, and I apologize. But I still have these girls' numbers who are single, so we'll try next time. All right.
Better not be
all right,
well,
I'm tentatively on the pro Sam Cedar bullying Emma campaign.
Well, you and Matt are going to have to do some sort of lottery system because he's asked for the same.
Like a bachelor.
Right, exactly. You two are going to have to compete over my friends, I think, at this point, because Matt has also asked for the same connect.
All right. It'll be a physical contest. Whoever can lift the heaviest object over their head.
Oh, boy.
I don't think that should be there.
Matt would like to change the contours of this competition. But all right, Kowalski, I'll figure it out next time. Apologies.
All good. You all have a good one.
You bye. Too.
It's like the Glengarry leads.
Calling from a 574 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Bob from Indiana.
Bob from Indiana, what's on your mind?
Well, I've called you before. I told you when Mate Juan was free, and I also am the one who informed you why you should feel safer as a Jew because of Israel. But I'm calling today on that topic. Did you see how Netanyahu was on Israeli television bragging about leading Trump into the war?
I think I did see that clip.
I mean, he did it in Hebrew, so obviously we can't put anything about it on American media because no one can translate Hebrew.
You're being facetious, but yes, I get your point.
It's saying that we don't cover this stuff, and it's like American media is all worried about Hassan. Now, let me be honest, I'm an old boomer, but the fact that we're so worried about Hassan Piker when all this other stuff is burning down around us is driving me insane, and I don't know how to deal with it. Of course, I also live in Indiana, so I'm already surrounded by idiots, but there you go.
Well, I mean, I think your reaction is warranted. I mean, look, the important thing, I think, to come out of this, and Hassan, at the end of the day, is going to be fine because time is on his side. The reason why this has traveled and has been prolonged so much is because it's being pushed by a specific cohort within the Democratic Party, or maybe two that, you know, the Venn diagram, you know, largely overlaps. The Zionist lobby within the context of the Democratic Party. And the corporatist wing of the Democratic Party. Again, there's a significant overlap here. They are afraid that the more progressive wing of the party, which is, you know, more or less a coalition between progressives and democratic socialists and then, you know, who were normie Democrats fed up with the failures of the Democratic leadership, they're afraid of this. And I think they really are afraid that Abdul al-Sayed will win. I think they're genuinely afraid of that, because if he wins in this purplish state,
mm-hmm.
then one of their key sort of arguments becomes a lot less salient, which is
we're electable.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know,
you can't hope for more. You have to elect the moderate.
There's no way, you know, we don't want to lose Michigan. You know, and they're very nervous, particularly in these swing states, right? Like, you know, it's one thing I understand that you've got, you know, maybe in Iowa, you know, that there's going to be someone whose politics I largely disagree with. But if progressives start winning in the swing states, what's the argument? Yeah, like, honestly, like, what's the argument that the Chuck Schumers, the Neera Tandons, the Third Way, what's their argument as to why we should, their set of policies should be followed? Because they never make the argument based upon the merits of it in and of itself. I mean, Mallory McMorrow, she ran, this is where she faltered, was that she tried to walk this sort of like tightrope and she couldn't do it. Like, she wanted to distinguish herself on Medicare for All. And the only problem she had with Medicare for All is that it's government run, which, yeah. But just like, so isn't Medicare. I mean,
yeah.
So like they don't have an actual argument. And but for some notion of there being more politically savvy an adult.
Liberals have no solutions.
And but their argument has been, you children do not understand. You have no idea what it's like out there.
Yeah.
And you don't get it. And if that argument falls apart, they got nothing. They got nothing. Yeah. Appreciate the call.
Okay, thank you. Have a good one.
Bye. Thank you. Yeah, I think the theme there is, what is the use of winning elections if Trump is just going to get back into power? It's the same reason that these impeachment Democrats have fallen so flat in these primary races, whether it's Diana DeGette, whether it's Dan Goldman.
Vindman.
Was Thandahar involved in impeachment? Shri, and I'm not saying his last name right.
Shri Thanadar.
Thanadar, not Thandadar. Thanadar.
I don't know, but I did find out he was 71 years old, and he looks great for his age.
He filed articles of impeachment in 2025, right. And that was because he was so that wasn't,
and everyone rolled their eyes,
right?
At
because it was, he was worried about the McKinney challenge, but and he was right to be worried about it. But okay, so putting him aside though, but Vindman is another example. DeGette, Vindman, Dan Goldman. Why are you selling your failed impeachment efforts to the public, to the Democratic electorate? They're like, okay, cool. You were a part of the impeachment proceedings. What happened then? So, you know, that they've lost credibility there. And so, yeah.
Michigan leftists, Abdul would be great, but just imagine if Angie won, they'd have no counter. I mean, it'll
be insane.
That would be insane.
Did you see AOC just endorsed?
Angie Nixon?
Yeah. She's been pretty judicious, and I don't know. I don't know. I'm.
It's nice of AOC to do.
Good job, AOC. I don't know. I'm just wondering what the internals say. That's all.
My guess is that's a freebie.
Of course it is.
Because it is so outside of like the odds that a Democrat's going to win in a state with a 1.5 million person Republican advantage.
But what about those independents?
I'm willing to bet on this, but
I'm not going to bet. I'm not going to bet. And you know my thought on it. I give it 5% chance. I give it 5%.
But yes, of course. It would be great. It would be great, obviously. If she won, it would be.
Maybe at 7.
It would be revolutionary.
By November, I'm going to be at like 96, and I have totally forgotten the Kamala thing. Jeez. And then we'll have election night, and I'll be even more broken.
You're like the Cleveland Browns fan who gets the Super Bowl tattoo during the preseason.
I truly am.
But look, listen, it's not impossible. I mean, it's
worth the effort.
It's 100% worth the effort, because this is not an overnight project.
Yep.
And Trump has alienated a lot of Latin voters, and sending several dozen Cubans to the heart of Africa as a deportation, I have no sense, but off the top of my head, I would imagine is not going to play very well in certain circles.
And there are a lot of black voters in Florida and in some of these southern states with a larger black population. We're seeing mass mobilization and outrage over the efforts to disenfranchise them all across the South.
And
in a statewide race, you can't gerrymander. That's in part what's being, I mean, I think that's part of what Angie Nixon, why that took them by surprise. I mean, maybe a little bit, some of that anger. In addition to her ability as an organizer. So again, like, hopium here. But if that happened, I might actually levitate off the ground and ascend into heaven, and you will never hear from me again.
I mean, I think that, like, you know, often in red states, the progressives, in that, or I should say the Democrats in these red states tend to be more progressive because they're more isolated. They're surrounded by this. There's, you know, they're already being called communists. And so there's not the same sort of cost associated with it. And the frankly, the Democratic Party there is the establishment Democratic Party is weak and has not done a very good job. So anybody who comes in with any type of organizing can within the Democratic Party. It's not impossible. It's highly unlikely. But the upside is this is about building something in the future. This is about maybe figuring out how we're going to win back one or two of those congressional seats that have been gerrymandered out. Maybe down the road, you know, foreclosures, Florida, year over year, I think foreclosures are up 10% in this country. Florida is like one of the top states that is experiencing foreclosures. As climate change hits, you know, Georgia didn't happen overnight.
Right.
Florida is not going to either. But we'll see. The organizing is helpful. Nicola, it's not impossible and it's worth the effort. Yes, 1,000 times. We cannot get what we want if we don't have this attitude. Pessimism of the intellect is healthy enough, but we must be balanced with the optimism of the will, quoting Gramsci, if I'm not mistaken.
That's very nice. I'll provide the optimism of the will. The magical thinking of the gambler.
Reflecting pool algae. Other than Tim Miller, who you played yesterday, the former Republicans are just as bad. Charlie Sykes, who used to be at the Bulwark, posted that Hassan is bad, but Ilhan is worse. And then in the next 2 days, posted three more times about Hassan and only once about Ilhan.
Yeah, who's that dumb lady that works at the Bulwark?
I will tell you, Charlie Sykes. I remember when this dude was a right-wing AM talk radio host in Wisconsin. And he was horrific. Horrific. And what's more disturbing about Sykes to me, I don't know his politics today. I don't really have a sense of that. I know he was like an MSNBC, you know, resistance Republican. But for him to make that switch, I just think that, like, as a human being, it's almost more disturbing to me that someone could actually, like, have poured this shit into our society and either have the capacity to pretend he's not like that anymore or to have had the capacity to pretend he was like that before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, their relationship to politics and society is so disturbing and so twisted in my mind. Like, you're playing this character for money and had no sense. And let's be clear also, this is a guy, Wisconsin was a shit show back when he was an AM talk radio host. That's when Scott Walker arose. That's when we had cutting Medicaid, where we attacked unions. I mean, much of what we see today is a function of people like that and what they did during the aughts and after. And I, you know, God bless you. You're trying to do your penance, but I don't know. I don't know if there's enough penance in the world to fill that bucket.
Every time I see, I'm sorry, Henry Cuellar's name, I know that we haven't talked about this yet, but Matt just pulled this up. The eight Democrats that voted to condemn socialism and DSA. Every time I see Henry Cuellar's goddamn name, I think about Nancy Pelosi and Jim Clyburn going down to Texas and putting their thumb on the scales in that primary with Kristen Gonzalez, who would have been one of our best members of, or not, I'm sorry, it's not Kristen Gonzalez. She's in New York. I'm forgetting the name of the Democrat. I'm sorry. But man, this guy votes with Republicans every single time, Henry Cuellar, for the most part.
Yep.
Anti-abortion Democrat.
It was 2024, was it?
She ran twice against him.
His most recent was at Villarreal. I forget who the
But she won by
but he barely
Cisneros. Yeah.
Call him from a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hey, Sam. It's Raygun.
Ronald Raygun. It's like the hit parade today.
Yeah, lots of immigration talk, but I need to address Mindy.
Okay.
I hadn't thought about Mindy in like 9 years, and then she called in like 3 weeks ago. And out of nowhere, is like, I don't like Raygun.
Wait, what?
I forgot about that.
But was that 3 weeks ago or was that 6 weeks ago?
It was. I think it was your last day before you went on.
Okay, so that was eight weeks ago.
This is the weird thing. I remembered having beef with her, but I didn't remember why. So I had to go back and look this up. And on October 25th, 2017, she tweeted, "Fuck you, Raygun, frustrated loser scriptwriter," and she tagged Majority Report, Michael Brooks, and me.
Why, Raygun?
And she then accused me, like, she was tweeting at a bunch of different people saying, "Fuck you, Raygun, I'm on to you," and it wasn't me. It was random people. She thought
Doesn't
I was using,
like,
sock puppet accounts to mess with her. Anyways, Michael helped us smooth this over.
That's
R.I.P.
good.
R.I.P. Shout out to Michael. And so I'm thinking, like, the hatchet's been buried. You know, this is like almost 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, she drops the nuclear bomb. And on top of that, she acts like she watches the show but doesn't know if you're married and also seems confused about fisting.
Okay.
Anyways, yep. The point is, I was really gonna bring the heat, and I thought of a bunch of mean stuff to say about Mindy. But instead, I just want to say, Mindy, you're great, and I wish you didn't hate me so much.
Well,
that's it.
I appreciate your coming on to say that, and hopefully, we can.
Mend fences between
Mend
our
fences.
Viewers.
Ronald Raygun, ladies and
I would actually, I would encourage her to reach out to me on Manect, and we can smooth it out.
Okay. We'll let her know you're available on Manect. Appreciate the call.
Manect.com.
Manect.com. Right.
Yep.
What was the rate for that again?
I think it was like $15,000 a minute. we should say that... Ronald Raygun is an immigration attorney, and it's a shit show right now. So this is almost like a support line for him. All right, one quick one. 516, you are the final caller of the day.
Mike Mad Dog, first time, long time.
Mike Mad Dog, where are you calling from?
Oh, hey, this is Little Buster Blues out in Long Island.
Okay.
Where in Long Island?
Long Island. The Long Island.
Right. Well, I thought you said something before that. Never mind.
Okay.
Oh, did you say, sorry, I can't really hear you guys well, but did you say where in Long Island?
Well, you said Long Island, and then I was curious.
Hey, anyway, I'll try and be quick. Wanted to talk about sports.
Cool.
All the leagues seem to think that the salary cap is going to go up forever. And I'm starting to hear a lot more on, like, the Bro Ringer podcast world about this Lakers sale being shady. Yeah. And, you know, a lot more they're having a little trouble keeping the straight face about gambling, even though they're still reading the ads.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it just seems like this has got to be a way in for a lot of people who don't give any shit about anything but sports. It's the only way to explain the economy to people, I feel like, right now, is that, you know, do you think this can go up forever? And I worry that, like, this is very analogous for our like, AI bubble right now, where it's like...
So, wait, you're essentially saying that gambling and the proliferation of it is bringing in so much money to these professional sports leagues that they're raising the salary cap at a clip that's not going to be able to be kept up with, in the same way that AI is overflating the value of our economy. Is that your claim?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's that's a given that, like, AI investment and foreign investment is the only way that these numbers keep going up so dramatically.
Well, I will say that the salary cap, though, doesn't need to go down at all. It actually, even if everything were to fall apart, should increase because ownership takes way too much of a stake in what the physical labor of the players actually provides for them. So we shouldn't worry or cede the framing that the salary cap should go down, just like wages shouldn't go down. The ownership class, capitalist class, needs to be able to bear the brunt of their speculation that destroying the economy.
Well, that is the point, though. Like, they are overvaluing these things because they are assets that they assumed would just inflate in value forever. And we saw the big cap bump in the NBA, at least, like 10 years ago, because sports in particular were one of the things that were more insulated from ad revenue drying up because they are live. You need to watch them live and that sort of thing. But Pablo Torre had this was the, I think, with the New York Times, and I think this kind of speaks to what the caller was talking about here.
Anybody who thinks that sports fandom is an inelastic demand is naive. I think there are ways to break the public trust. I think there is a disregard for the customer that can jeopardize the customer's affection for you. And I also, to speak the language now of institutional investing, I think when you have a team like the Lakers being priced at $12.5 billion, which is approximately 20 times revenue, you're operating truly rarefied air. What else has that multiplier?
Right.
The only thing that has it, broadly speaking, is sports. Because of this secret human component, the question I think the Lakers transaction raises and that this entire conversation is driving to is sports, therefore, as currently evaluated, a bubble?
Interesting.
Have we overpriced this? Can you possibly grow and get more returns on investment when you're already at $12.5 billion?
Yeah. Is this unsustainable?
Is it unsustainable? Is this going to pop?
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, are you wrecking the thing that was astride American culture, the last remaining monoculture?
Great, great points. Yep. And I will say, too, that NFL is talking about expanding its teams into the overseas markets. That's why they're fixated on doing international games in Australia, Germany. They want a team in London. And this is about also like they're diluting the talent pool with increased expansion because they think the money is going to continue to print and print and print. And I thought that was very well said.
I mean, the NBA is having injury issues now, and everybody knows from the players to the commentators to the coaches that, oh, we need to play less games because of the way the game's being played now. And the answer from ownership, these giant companies that now, you know, put the team together to pay billions and billions of dollars for this, like, yeah, but why would that cut into our revenue? Of course we're not going to do that.
The NFL added, a few years ago, it's a 17-game season, and we all know that the inevitability is the 18-game season. And they're making these players play on Thursday, which increases injury risk exponentially because they don't have full week recovery time. Yeah, the product, I have never been less invested in sports in my life. And I'm still pretty invested. But I'm having a hard time caring. It's so financialized. The gambling that is all over the screen it's dehumanizing the very human elements of sports. The glory, the triumph of the will, the artistry, the obviously the physicality, like the beauty of competition has become so infected with money that it is hurting my relationship with like the NFL right now in particular. The NBA, I'm on a high because of the Knicks, but like, you know, it's...
But look at Mavs fans. Like they got their team bought up by a giant corporation. They had like a front man owner, Mark Cuban, who now says like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have sold it to these bad people. Uh-huh.
Give the money back.
Yeah, exactly.
And look at the Bears. Bears are like, yep, because the ownership wants to leave the iconic Soldier Field to go to Indiana. That's where they're going to build their stadium.
That's where they belong.
I mean, well, didn't you just draft Caleb Williams Brian's in fantasy? Good luck, Brian. But
I care less where they play.
Yeah, my point being,
this is lack of interest in sports.
Yes, I attributed it to just being so obsessed with politics, and right now stuff with work, we're doing more and more work. It's been a little crazy, but I don't think it's just that. I mean, to what you're saying, caller, I think there's a lot of people right now that are developing less of an emotional relationship with the product as there's more commodification in sports.
Thanks for the call, and that ends our call-in portion of the program. I'll read a couple IMs, and then we will say goodbye. Dolink, suggest editing your excellent interviews to stand alone. Easier to share on social media with friends who don't listen to the show. Difficult to get them to listen to 30 minutes before you get to the interview. We do that for the most part.
We clip interviews.
I wonder if we have a playlist. Do we have a playlist of interviews only? Yeah, right?
Yeah,
so head to our YouTube channel and look for the playlist of interviews only. I don't know what we call it. Maybe MR interviews.
Maybe they're talking about social media style, like, but no, those long form stuff, they live on YouTube.
Yep. Five more. Done well. Sam, I spoke with Cody Johnson from Some More News last night. They want War Mambo to be the official West Coast Majority Report correspondent. He also apologized for calling you elderly. Yeah, I've heard rumors that I was being called old last night.
Hmm.
Not necessarily inaccurate, but
pretty much joking.
Someone like Krusty Known looks like Moulton won in some seats in his old district, North Shore and Cape Ann. Yeah, like that's up like near Rockport and Gloucester and that whole area. Charlie Weirdos. Tuna. Sam, when are you going to train your cat to use your bidet? Hello, Cat Tushy. Hey, Trey. But do you condemn Hassan Piker? Let's get another one. Schartenfreude. Matt would like... Oh, wait. No, this is some... I missed that. Michigan Fist. Matt would like the competition criteria to be the largest number of collected sound drops. Where did
Schartenfreude... She doesn't mean that.
Schartenfreude. Did you see the latest quote from shitbird James Carville? Why do the Democrats need for anything and just thinks the D's need to be against Trump and that's it? Contemptible. Also, just fundamentally wrong. This guy, I mean, people forget this, but he literally said Democrats should do nothing until in 2025. He said Democrats should do nothing until, like September, December of 2025. And fortunately, nobody listened to him, and Wisconsin's in a very, very different place because of that. And there's no Doge because of that. People forget how absolutely wrong he was. And also, when was the last time he was right? Born Blue. Haven't seen this in national media, but I'm in a signal group for ice sightings in Indianapolis. It's been pretty quiet and sporadic for months. In the past couple of days, there are near constant reports. The mayor's office just issued a relatively toothless statement as a blue dot in a red state were expected to be a target at some point. And the final IM of the day. Dark Soul. Milo looked at his hands and saw a lack of melanin. So there were no clues. Matt, Brian, Emma, great job today, folks. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright.
option where the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive.